Now it's recording. Okay, so good morning. Welcome to Narquise Street. It's June 11th, 2011. We're in the upper room. And glad to have everyone here with us this morning. This last week, which holiday was celebrated?
Shavuot.
Right? And what is the text that's read during Shavuot, the Megillah, the scroll, Ruth? Yeah. So I want to look at one aspect of Ruth this morning, and actually we'll just take a little glance at Ruth. But before we start, let's pray. Lord, thank you for bringing us here this morning on the Shabbat. Thank you for your continual reminders of your grace and how much you love us. And open your word to us. Speak to us in a fresh way and to each one of our lives. In a way that we weren't expecting, and draw us closer to you, to know you more. In your name we pray, Jesus. Amen. So, if you could turn to Ruth chapter 3, Randy, I was wondering if you could read in Hebrew the, I guess like the first 13 verses. And you can follow along in English or whatever your translation is. Ruth chapter 3, starting in verse 1.
No, right. I'm fine. I'll get there.
Okay. You want to use mine? Here, use this.
What's that? This is bigger.
Oh, that is.
Yeah, that's easier to read. Would you like to take this?
Okay.
It's terrible.
No, it's not terrible.
It's very handy.
It's about a 4-inch evil Bible.
Ruth chapter 3.
Ruth chapter 3. Vatomela. Vatomela Naomi Hamota. Biti. Alors la Keshna Manoa. Kasheritabla. Verata. Hello, Boaz. מודעתנו אשר היית נערותיו, הנה הוא זורא את גורן הסעורים הלילה. ורחצת, בסחת, בסמת שמלותייך עלייך, וירד את הגורן. אל תימני לאיש, אל תחלותו לאכול ולשתות. והיא משוכבו וידעת את המקום אשר נשכב שם. ובאת וגילית מרגלותיו ושכב והוא יגיד לך את אשר תעשין ותאמר אליה כל אשר תאמרי אליי אעשה ותבן הגורן ותעש ככל אשר כמעט החמותה ויוכל בועז וישת ויתב ליבו ויבוא לשכב בקצה הערימה, ותבוא ולט, ותגל מרגלותיו, ותשכב. ויהי בחצי הלילה, ויחרד האיש, וילווה, והנה אישה שוכבת מרגלותיו. ויאמר, מי את? ותאמר, אנוכי רות אמתך. ופרסת כנפיך על אמתך, על אמתך, כי גואל אתה. ויאמר, ברוכה את לאדוני ביתי, היטב חסדך האחרון מן הראשון, לבלתי לכת אחרי הבחורים עם דל ועם עשיר. ואתה איתי, אל תראי, כל אשר תאמרי אעשה לך, יודע כל שער עמי, כי אשת חיל את. ואתה, כי אמנם כי גואל אנוכי, וגם יש גואל קרוב ממני.
Okay, let's stop there.
Okay.
That's the important line. The pertinent line for what we want to, that last line there. You know, if I, he's basically saying, if I can redeem, I can be the redeemer. But there's also kinsman redeemer, a redeemer who's closer than I am. Karov mimeni. And this is the aspect today about what is this idea of redemption or to redeem. Ruth here, who is Ruth, and who does she represent in this story? I mean, Ruth is many things. In a way, she's a mystic.
Gentiles.
Okay, right. Mystically and spiritually, we talk about her representing Gentiles and foreigner and widow, etc. But down to the facts of the story, who has sent her to be the representative here? Her mother-in-law. Okay, so what's the situation with her mother-in-law?
She needs more shield for vision.
She's a widow.
She's a widow. And her husband... What?
She has no descendants.
She has no descendants. What's the story? What happened? Her husband... And she had two sons. And her husband and her two sons died with no grandchildren. And... Where did they originally come from? Naomi and Elimelech, that's her husband. So they're from the area there of Bethlehem. And, okay, actually, let's go to chapter 4 because this goes into the more detail, which most of us know. Randy, could you read from chapter 4, starting in verse 1 to verse 10?
בועז עלה השער, וישב שם, והנה הגואל עובר, אשר דיבר בועז. ויאמר, צור שבא בו, פלוני אלמוני, ויעשר וישב. ויקח 10 אנשים מזבני העיר, ויאמר, שבו פה, וישב. ויאמר לגואל, חלקת השדה אשר לאחינו לאלימלך, מכרה נעמי, השב המשדה מואב. ואני אמרתי, אגלה אוזנך לאמור, כדי נגד היושבים ונגד זקני עמי, אם תגעל, געל, ואם לא יגעל, הגיד עלי, ואדע כי אין זולתך לגאול. ואנוכי אחריך, ויאמר, אנוכי אדאר, ויאמר בועז, ביום כנותך השדה מיד נעמי, ומעט רות המואביה אשת המת, קנית להקים שם המת על נחלתו. ויאמר הגואל, לא אוכל לגאול לי, פן אשחית את נחלתי, גאלך אתה. גאה לך אתה את גאולתי, כי לא אוכל לגאול. וזאת בפנים בישראל על הגאולה ועל התמורה לקיים כל דבר. שלח איש נעלו ונתן לרעהו, וזאת התעודה בישראל. ויאמר הגואל לבועז, קנה לך. וישלוף נעלו. ויאמר בועז, להזכינים כל העם, עדים אתם היום, כי קניתי את כל אשר לאלימלך, ואת כל אשר לחיליון ומחלון, מיד נעמי. וגם את רות המואביה, אשת מחלון, קניתי לי לאישה, להקים שם המת על נחלתו. ולא ייקרא את שם המת, נעים החיים, ונשאר מקומו. סליחה, זה נכון? נעים אחד, נעים אחד, ונשאר מקומו. עדים אתם היום.
Thank you.
You have a Hebrew Bible?
Just pull it up. So, here we have the, what do we learn here about Naomi and her husband, their situation? Why is Ruth involved?
She chose to stay.
Right, she chose to stay, but what's Naomi trying to get? Is she just trying to get her daughter-in-law married off, or is there something involved here?
Something to do with redemption of land or something?
Yeah, it involves property, it involves money. And just like today, you know, the Bible is very, it's talking about practical facts, survival, and so, yeah, maybe we should turn this on.
Yeah, that's probably why they made it.
Okay, I'll speak up. So, this isn't just about having a grandson. This is about property and inheritance and things being passed down from generation to generation, which is a bit understandable today, but really in our whole world of globalism, and especially in America, where people just kind of move and go, they really have no connection to the land anymore.
She already owns the land, but there's no way for her to make a living on the land?
This is, well, no. I mean, from my understanding, you're welcome if anybody else has insights as well. From my understanding, the land has been bought or owned by another party. And so, Sharon, Randy, or...
They might have sold it off when they took off to go to Moab.
To go to Moab.
Some money so they could set up some new houses. So.
Yes, this is what she sold.
Yeah.
So they have years that the guy who bought it would have had to consult with the relatives, right?
Well,
Jubilee.
Let's turn and look at Leviticus 25. Let's talk first about the land aspect. Leviticus 25. This is one of the most interesting chapters I find in the Bible. There's lots of details here about how the Israelites practiced property and, I guess, slavery or how they would get out of it. It's quite interesting. Starting verse 1, from verse 1 to verse 7, this is known as the Shnat Shemitah, which is every seventh year you're supposed to not sow your land and let it and then reap from it, right? Which I'm sure most of you have heard about. So it's like a rest for the land every seventh year, which fits nicely with the whole week concept that we have. On the seventh day, you're supposed to rest and not work. So the land does it, except it's based on a yearly, 7-year cycle. Then into verse 8, it kind of ups the ante where it's not only every seventh year, but 7 Sabbaths of years, which would be 7 times 7, 49, you come to this Jubilee, this 50th year. So it's almost like, and again, nobody knows exactly how this was done. This is all kind of being put together because you don't see a lot of evidence in the biblical account of how the Jubilee was practiced. Actually, very little to none. But it seems like there was a double Sabbath. So the 49th and the 50th year, you wouldn't work your land. So it's a double whammy. And And it starts there in verse 8. The Jubilee will start on the Day of Atonement, specifically. Verse 10, consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a Jubilee for you. Each one of you is to return to his family property and each to his own clan. So, not only is the land being freed from work, but also people are being freed from whatever held them. You return to your inheritance. And we'll get more specifics here. Verse 13, in the Jubilee, everyone is to return to his own property. Verse 14, if you sell land to one of your countrymen or buy any from him, do not take advantage of each other. You are to buy from your countrymen on the basis of the number of years since the Jubilee. So there was some type of system. You had 50 years, and maybe it's like a mortgage. Today you have these 40-year mortgages or 30-year mortgages or 20-year mortgages when you buy a house with a bank. And a person might buy the land from you, but at the end of the 50 years, they actually didn't buy it. It's like they leased it. They do this in Israel today, except it's based on 100 years, isn't it? I think the lease.
90, I think it's the 90 years.
90th, right, or something. It's quite much longer, but it's like you can never really own property in this country. You're just leasing it for your lifetime and a few years after that, depending on how healthy you are. So the value of a person would basically lease it, buy it. I put, you know, my, what do you call this around it? What do you call these? Quotation marks, okay. And then it goes back to the family, the clan, the group of people that you come from. Let's see, verse 19. Again, and the reason why, you know, Leviticus, Deuteronomy has this idea, the reason why you do all these things is because if you don't, then God will, you'll be in trouble. There'll be curses, the land will spit you out. It'll be bad for you, and if you do it, you'll be blessed. Verse 23: the land must not be sold permanently, because the land is mine. Now this is a key point here. The land is mine. So God says the land is mine, and you are but aliens and my tenants. Throughout the country that you hold as a possession, you must provide for the redemption of the land. So, on one hand, you have this theology that the land is Israel's, right? God gave Canaan to the people of Israel. But on the other hand, if you take that circle even further in, God says, no, it's not even yours, it's mine. And you're just leasing it as well. So it's kind of like this picture or a type of, you know, you want to stay humble because you actually... you're never the owner. It's I'm the owner. And you're just leasing from me. God's the owner. And I think that's something, you know, very applicable in our own lives and how we approach our possessions. Again, because we're all going to die. We don't ever really possess anything. And even, you know, how we go into... Alright, thanks, Dora. So, let's keep going here. Verse 25. If one of your countrymen becomes poor and sells some of his property, his nearest relative is to come and redeem what his countryman has sold. If, however, a man has no one to redeem it for him, but he himself prospers and acquires sufficient means to redeem it, he is to determine the value for the years since he sold it and refund the balance to the man to whom he sold it. He can then go back to his own property. But if he does not acquire the means to repay him, what he sold will remain in the possession of the buyer until the year of Jubilee. Let's skip down to verse 35. If one of your countrymen becomes poor and is unable to support himself among you, help him as you would an alien or a temporary resident so he can continue to live among you. Do not take interest of any kind from him, but fear your God. So that your countrymen may continue to live among you. You must not lend him money at interest or sell him food at a profit. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. You know, it's this idea again. If it's family, if it's a brother, in Hebrew it uses the word ach, you know. Anyone who's from your nation, you're just to basically be like one big extended family. Of course, we know in reality that never works. Call it the sinful nature, call it whatever you want, but people take advantage of situations. But this is how it's supposed to work. Now, if it's someone who's not an Israelite, you'll notice there's really no, you know, you should treat them a certain way, but they don't really have special rights. So just keep that in mind, that, you know, this is a progressive revelation we're getting here. Verse 39, if one of your countrymen becomes poor among you and sells himself to you, do not make him work as a slave. He is to be treated as a hired worker or a temporary resident among you. He is to work for you until the year of Jubilee. Then he and his children are to be released, and he will go back to his own clan and to the property of his forefathers. Because the Israelites are my servants, whom I brought out of Egypt, they must not be sold as slaves. Do not rule over them ruthlessly. I guess that's a pun there, ruthlessly, since we're talking about Ruth Day. But fear your God. Your male and female slaves are to come from the nations around you. From them you may buy slaves. You may also buy some of the temporary residents living among you and members of their clans born in your country, and they will become your property. You can will them to your children as inherited property and can make them slaves for life, but you must not rule over your fellow Israelites ruthlessly. If an alien or temporary resident among you becomes rich and one of your countrymen becomes poor and sells himself to the alien living among you or to a member of the alien's clan, he retains the right of redemption after he has sold himself. One of his relatives may redeem him. An uncle, or a cousin, or any blood relative in his clan may redeem him. Or if he prospers, he may redeem himself. He and his buyer are to count the time from the year he sold himself up to the year of Jubilee. The price for his release is to be based on the rate paid to a hired man for that number of years. By the way, how many years was Ruth and... not Ruth... Naomi and her family in Moab? 10 years. Yeah, at least 10. So, again, who knows? Maybe when they left, again, they sold their land for this 50-year period, or maybe it was at that point 33, depending on where the Jubilee fell, but it's something to kind of keep into the bigger picture there. Verse 52, if only a few years remain until the year of Jubilee, he is to compute that and pay for his redemption accordingly. He is to be treated as a man hired from year to year. You must see to it that his owner does not rule over him ruthlessly. Even if he is not redeemed in any of these ways, he and his children are to be released in the year of Jubilee. For the Israelites belong to me as servants. They are my servants, whom I brought out of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. And here in Hebrew, it says the Israelites belong to me as, well, in the NIV it says servants. In Hebrew it's avadim, which is slaves. A lot of times it can be translated slave or servant, but I think it generally means the exact same thing. It's a slave in our idea of modern English. So God is saying the Israelites belong to me as slaves. They are my slaves, whom I brought out of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. And everyone knows the whole story of Egypt is based on Israelites being slaves. They have no land, and they're slaves. And so the Jubilee is kind of this echo of Egypt again, the whole experience of coming out of Egypt, of being freed from slavery, of coming to a place where they're reclaiming their inheritance, which I guess you could tie back to Abraham, where God says, I'm giving this land to your descendants. And so in a way, it's like one big jubilee of being free from slavery and reclaiming your inheritance.
While we're talking about this redemption of land, I'm curious to hear what they say in English.
Different versions?
At the end of verse 3, there is
first that I think in Jewish, I haven't checked this, but I think in Jewish traditions, it often is looked on as, I briefly mentioned, that they may have, she may have sold the property rights, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And now Boaz and Ruth and others are, in a sense, asking to have those property rights bought back.
Right.
You know, like, you know, pay for those receipts so we can start using the land again ourselves.
Right.
But I don't think English versions read it that way. So
you're talking about Ruth chapter 4, verse 3?
Ruth chapter 4, verse 3, where it says, Naomi sold the land. Here's somebody that has English. Okay.
Please tell me
more. Say what version it is. Say what version it is, maybe, and read verse 3, and it'd be fun to hear about 5 or 6 versions.
I'll read mine.
Sure.
And Boaz said to the family redeemer, you know Naomi, who came back from Moab. She is selling the land that belonged to our relative Elimelech.
Okay, she is selling. And what version was that?
The one you don't like.
I like them all. The New Living Translation. That's a fine translation. I've always said that all translations were a lot of work by often many people, sweat and tears, working very, very hard.
He wrote it to his children, and that just
makes
my mind.
Right. But
Lee,
you have
thoughts? Yeah. I have this ESV, chapter 3, 4, verse 3. Then he said to the Redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech.
Okay. And how about over here? What's this one?
This is the New King James. Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold the piece of land.
Interesting.
Past.
So an English version dares to go past. How about that?
I have the original King James. It sounds just like this. It's selling.
What says?
Is selling.
What says though?
Sell. Which is the present continuous.
Now speak it. So what NIV. Version do you have?
NIV.
NIV says?
Then he said to the kinsman redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our brother Elimelech.
Her husband?
So what would you like to say about that?
Are there any other versions? We got one so far that's not... Everyone's been, you selling.
Like in, right now.
Or we got one sold. Boss, what do you mean?
Yeah, sold. Naomi was coming back from land and one has to sell a piece of land.
Has to sell.
NASB.
She has to sell. That's different. So no, it's not really present. That's actually what you would call a volitional. That's a...
you could read that, but...
That's a deontic... No, she has to sell is different from she has sold.
Yeah, it could be just possessive. She has to sell. It doesn't mean it's a volitional.
Well... But it depends where you put the object. If you put the, she has a property to sell, that's like you were saying, but if she has to sell the property, then it means must. I think that was a must, wasn't it? What does it say again?
Naomi, then, the whole verse. Then he said to the closest relative, Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell a piece of land which belonged to our brother.
That's a must. That's a deontic volitional, an obligatory
So that pretty much covers it. Anybody have something different? Do you have a different translation?
Not in ASB.
Oh. Does anybody have anything else different? Okay, that was enough, Gary. I just wanted to get a survey of
the NRSV has his cell.
Right, but several have his cells.
But this is my guess. What you're trying to say is, from the context, shouldn't it be that she had sold her property?
Well, it depends on the culture.
Right.
You see, this is a cultural thing that we don't understand.
Right.
It's not part of our culture. And consequently, people translate, they try to make sense of it.
Right.
Because later on it says, you know, buy this because you'll buy it from Naomi.
Right.
And since it says you buy it from Naomi, it sounds like it can't refer to, you know, you're not buying it from the person that Naomi already sold it to.
Right.
As we would think of it. And yet here it's like you buy it from Naomi, and yet the Hebrew verb choice looks like, more probably it looks like, she sold it already. And so that would be a whole different cultural framework. If you don't have that Jubilee kind of inheritance.
It's always yours.
That it's yours.
Even when you sell it.
Right. If you don't have that cultural framework, this isn't going to make any sense whatsoever.
Right.
And I think that's what we've heard in 95% of our versions here. They've taken it and tried to make sense of it within a sold, it's now the new person's property framework.
Right.
And so they have to translate is selling, has to sell.
But it's really sold with a Jubilee understanding.
It's
from the it will be a lease, which gives the right to possession with the reversion that comes in at the time of Jubilee.
Or something.
Okay, well.
But she's selling it to her own family. I mean, she's selling it with the idea.
My understanding, I mean, the way it looks like is obviously, say the property costs $10,000, like she has to pay the person who's had the property, say $10,000. She doesn't have $10,000. So Boaz is buying it through her paying this person,
but it's coming through her.
I mean, this is just the way I'm seeing it.
Yeah, that's
like she's the channel to pay it.
And that's why I keep saying something like that, because we don't really know. There's no, we don't have a little handbook that says, here's how to live like an ancient Israelite. We have to read texts like this and try to figure out just how things worked back then.
Yeah.
Because we don't know.
And it didn't work for long, did it? This Jubilee year didn't come into operation for very long.
Well, there's not hardly any evidence for it in the Bible. Yeah. They're just Leviticus 25, and then there's little hints of stuff, but nothing.
Then there's a hint that it wasn't working well because in the exile, you know, the land would finally get the Jubilees.
Right.
So,
right. That's what Chronicles says. That
like you weren't doing it.
You weren't letting the land lie fallow. What's the other thing that happens here that's very strange in this Ruth chapter 4? There's a weird ceremony that's done.
Sandal.
Right, the sandal. And the writer of Ruth talks about, in verse 7, if you look in your English translations, there might be, is it parentheses? These things? Parenthetical comment, where the writer is saying, now in earlier times, they used to do this.
Mm-hmm.
It would be like, I mean, you can think about in your own cultures, well, when my grandma was alive, they used to have an ice box. And, you know, this is how things were done. So the writer obviously is talking about this from back then. And in other words, his readers at that time would not practice the whole sandal business. He wasn't telling it to us, that's for sure. He was telling it to someone who was reading Hebrew time of Jesus prior to that. But Ruth, you know, we go way back much further, the actual story. Where is it mentioned in the Bible, the sandal handing business?
Sandal.
It's in Deuteronomy. Let's go to Deuteronomy real quick. Deuteronomy chapter 25. I think it is. Yeah, 25. Deuteronomy 25, verse 5. If brothers are living together and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family. Her husband's brother shall take her and marry her and fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to her. And we have a similar story like this in Genesis, right? Judas got three sons. The oldest son dies. His wife, what's her name?
Tamar.
She's given to him, to the second son, who, because she has no heir for Judah. He also dies because they're both wicked guys. So now there's the third son, and now she gets handed to the third son. But then the third son, no, I don't want to die, you know, because she's a black widow or who knows what, you know. And so this goes into the whole story of Judah and,
you know.
Sorry, not Judah. I know, but I'm sure under the text, the son is like saying, "Dad, don't give her to me," you know. I think it's pretty obvious. And so this goes in the whole story of Tamar and trying to get a son, because again, it's super important from these stories that we see with Ruth and Naomi and many stories in the Bible. You have to have a child to keep this inheritance in the family and so on. So let's keep reading. Deuteronomy 25, verse 6. The first son she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother, so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. However, if a man does not want to marry his brother's wife, she shall go to the elders at the town gate. So maybe this happened with Judah's third son, right? Maybe he did the exact same thing as with the sandal. My husband's brother refuses to carry on his brother's name in Israel. He will not fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to me. Then the elders of his town shall summon him and talk to him. And if he persists in saying, "I do not want to marry her," his brother's widow shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, take off one of his sandals, spit in his face, and say, "This is what is done to the man who will not build up his brother's family line. That man's line shall be known in Israel as the family of the unsandaled." And who knows? I mean, you know, today, you remember when George Bush had the shoe thrown out of his face in Iraq? You know, so you know the whole thing about shoes and feet and how it's kind of this unclean thing that's been passed down all these years. So who knows? Maybe it's something like showing the foot of the when you have the unsandaled thing. I don't know.
This passage is still in some symbolic or real manner today among religious Jews?
I think so. There was a movie done now, let's see, it's 37 years ago. It was a famous movie done in Israel called Roza Mi Ohevotcha, about a case where a girl becomes a widow and her brother. See, her brother-in-law is a 12-year-old boy who, of course, cannot fulfill this commandment. They're in an Orthodox community, and the whole movie traces the growing relationship between this 12-year-old boy and the young widow. You know, she's like a 21-year-old lady.
And eventually they do.
What happens with the sandals?
Yeah, the
they talk about it.
Okay, they talk about it.
I saw it 30.
They talk about it.
36.
Just like we're talking about it.
Yeah, I was wondering if that's why we're we get our phrase in English, filling the shoes of someone. Because it sounds like you can't fill his shoes. So.
Yeah, maybe.
Because filling the shoes is, you're talking about both shoes. Just taking off one sandal symbolically, you know, giving it to somebody.
But maybe it's still the same idea of
the shoe representing the person?
Yeah, the shoe represents the person.
Yeah.
and they're passing the buck their responsibility. Yeah. Like, here, you put on my shoes. I'm not going to wear them.
Do you want to discuss briefly the difference between Deuteronomy and Ruth?
Sure. Sure.
Okay. In Deuteronomy, who takes off the shoe?
The woman?
The woman. The woman takes off the shoe, spits in his face, and says, "Fooey on you."
And it's a bad thing. It's not evidence of a transaction.
But she's taken off one of his shoes.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Whereas here,
takes one of his
takes off his shoe and hands it to her.
Well, and this
says, "Fooey on me."
I mean, and this could just be a development of the tradition that watered it down more so that it wasn't so kind of offensive.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that's how it was actually done in public.
Right.
In other words, the watered down version might be how it actually got acted out in public.
Right.
But it's an interesting, it's an interesting tension there between the two.
Yeah.
You don't call it the house of the unsandaled. You just call them anonymous.
Right.
Instead of Ruth shaming him, we're leaving it anonymous in the text so you can maybe forget what.
In Ruth, in chapter 4, it says, I don't know what it says in English, but in Hebrew it basically calls him like Joe Blow or John Doe. It gives him this very kind of like that guy. Mr. Anonymous.
The one who stole it, who gave up the right.
Right. Because it's an embarrassment, right? To not fulfill the duty.
I find the difference of the use of verbs in Deuteronomy is chalatz.
Yeah.
And then it's in Ruth it is the shalat. About the same action.
Basically this
described differently.
Right.
What else do you mishlof? If you mishlof something, what are you doing?
You're getting ready to attack.
What?
You're getting ready to attack.
Yeah. Mishlof is often with a sword. But halutz. Who are the halutzim? Pioneers, because they
got to put their hands to the plow, not look back.
They're prepared. They're going forward. They're stepping out.
Yeah.
So what are you saying about Deuteronomy? You think that term is not quite shameful then, or is it shameful?
No, I think it's shameful in Deuteronomy. Spit in the face.
They're not in dogos.
Here spitting, and this also shows you culture. Here spitting is evil in Deuteronomy. It's a shame thing. There was a tribe across the river from where I used to live in Central Sudan, and they would spit blessings. The way, it was a blessing. You would spit and to pass on a blessing to someone.
In someone's face?
Grandfather. Well, not in the face.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. I never went to a spit.
Grandfathers do that already, because...
But the point is that they're spitting... if you say that the grandfather spit on him, you would think, oh, he blessed him. Whereas here, she spat on him, you think she cursed that blank.
Yeah.
S-O-B.
Yeah. Right.
So spitting, anyway.
So, kind of got to tie this all up here. Goel is the term in Hebrew for the redeemer, the kinsman redeemer, and it's also sometimes translated the avenger. There's Goel Dam, right? The redeemer of blood, Goel Dam, or avenger sometimes, or is often how it's translated. So I often think about this Goel as kind of like a godfather, of the clan, of the family. Someone who's powerful, someone who has money, because you need the money to buy people out of slavery, you need the money to buy back land. And another job that they're supposed to do besides redeeming, buying back land, buying back, you know, cousin Vinny who got himself enslaved because he went in debt gambling or whatever, is to avenge somebody in the family. So if one of the cousins was killed by someone from another clan, often you see the stories in the Bible about you go and the avenger can go and kill that person. Then there's these cities of refuge you've heard about. But the cities of refuge only count if you accidentally killed someone. So if you were working out in the woods and your axe head slipped off and hit a person, you can go. But if it's done out of premeditation, if it's done out of just murderous thoughts, which, you know, you can basically prove with evidence or whatever, then the city of refuge all goes out the window. You think of the story, is it Abner?
Yeah.
He kills the brother of... No, it's Yoav. Wait, I think it's Yoav. He kills his brother, and then he runs off to a city of refuge. He puts his, grabs onto the horns of the altar, and they still kill him right there, holding on to the horns, which is supposed to be this kind of merciful. But again, he did it out of, it doesn't count here. Yeah. So this is the goal of redeeming slaves, redeeming land, avenging of hurt to the clan, and then the other one is if, like what we see in Ruth, or we see in Judah's sons about Tamar needing an heir, so keeping seed in the family. And again, all this is really about money. It's about keeping things the way they should. Status quo is so huge here in the Middle East. You know, you don't want to, once you start changing facts on the ground, everybody, it gets really bad. So I want to, real quick as we close, Isaiah, the book of Isaiah talks all the time about God being a goel to Israel. What's the book of Isaiah about? What time period is Isaiah relating to? What's going on with Israel? Or actually, Israel doesn't exist anymore. It's Judah.
What chapter is that about?
I know, it's a huge book, but predominantly Isaiah is... Right, yeah, it doesn't matter all the time, but what's going on with Judah's political situation?
Being raped in the Shvela.
They're being...
beaten down.
In the Shvela?
Yeah.
Judah?
Yeah.
Okay, but who are the political powers that's...
They are caught. Syria. They are caught between the superpowers.
Right, that's Assyria at the beginning, but most of Isaiah is dealing with Babylon.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
If you go from...
Second of
Yeah, towards like the 20s, 30s, you're all in this period of Babylon. And what has Babylon done to Judah?
Isn't that chapter 44 next?
No, second starts in 39, but even before chapter 39, there's Babylon's in the mix. Like Hezekiah, they're saying because you showed, remember the Babylonian envoys came and he showed them the temple treasures, well, one day they're going to take them away, those guys. So what did Babylon do to Judah, right? What are the curse in history? They destroy the temple, they take the people into slavery, right? And what is the end of Isaiah all about? What's the prophecy all about?
Redeeming
the people. They're going to get their land back. They're going to come back to their land. Sorry?
Restoration.
Slavery, right? They're slaves in Babylon, but they're going to return to their land, which is the other thing. Just turn to... Isaiah 63. And we'll end with this. Isaiah 63. Who is this coming from Edom, from Bozrah, with his garment stained crimson? Who is this robed in splendor, striding forward in the greatness of his strength? It is I, speaking in righteousness, mighty to save. Why are your garments red, like those of one treading the winepress? I have trodden the winepress alone. From the nations no one was with me. I trampled them in my anger, and I trod them down in my wrath. Their blood spattered my garments, and I stained all my clothing. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and the year of my redemption has come. Okay, so if this is the same root here of goel, redemption, of redeeming. I looked, but there was no one to help. I was appalled, but no one gave support. So my own arm worked salvation for me, and my own wrath sustained me. I trampled the nations in my anger, and in my wrath I made them drunk and poured their blood on the ground. I will tell of the kindness of the Lord, the deeds for which he is to be praised, according to all the Lord has done for us. Yes, the many good things he has done for the house of Israel, according to his compassion and many kindness. He said, surely they are my people, sons who will not be false to me. And so he became their savior. In all their distress, he too was distressed, and the angel of his presence saved them. In his love and mercy, he redeemed them. He lifted them up, and he carried them all the days of old. And Isaiah often brings in this motif of Exodus, of the people being redeemed from slavery from Egypt, brought across the desert through the waters of the Red Sea, right? And God redeeming them. And here too, Isaiah is saying, look, this is like a second Exodus. You're coming out of slavery, you're going to go across the desert, this time not the desert in Sinai, but the desert from the Arabian one over there. And I'm going to bring you through, and I'm going to redeem you. And it's, again, it's this idea, God is, he's playing the kinsman redeemer here of Israel, where he's saving them, he's redeeming them, he's avenging them. Their enemies who have hurt them, he will repay them. And if we have more time, you can obviously kind of fast forward this idea into the New Testament with Jesus, where a lot of the ideas that we see in the New Testament of Jesus playing this part of God's kinsman redeemer, of being the person who will save, who will go and claim and say, they are mine, and I will take care of them. I will pull them out of slavery, if it's slavery of sin. I will give them their inheritance. Obviously, it's not of this earth, but it's something greater. And so this is a huge idea that hopefully will provoke you to read more in your scripture this week to see other connections to God's power to redeem and to save. So, Shabbat Shalom.